This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
And I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we'll be speaking about Israel, Palestine, Iraq, the media, and I have here in the studio with me Ali Abu Nima, who's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq, two websites. Ali Abu Nima, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
You've called these websites smart weapons that don't kill people. What do you mean by that?
The public today in America is waking up to the fact that they were lied to, that they were dragged into a quagmire in Iraq, that things are being done there in their name that most Americans don't want done, and they're paying a price for it. But that nothing that we know now was not known before the war. And Electronic Iraq was an effort to bring that information to people at the time it could have made a difference. And many people responded to such information, not to us. We don't claim credit for mobilizing millions of people, but millions of people did mobilize to stop the war in Iraq all over the world. And I feel that we nearly stopped it.
And part of the success was, excuse me for interrupting, was the skill of people using the internet.
Absolutely. And that's a lesson. So we don't go away from this feeling defeated, but feeling encouraged that on March 15th, 30 million people came out all over the world. And that today the public is moving more and more towards positions of sanity and moderation, even as the government continues to lurch from tragedy to error. And so we try to be the smart weapon of an informed public, at least to be one small contribution to that. And the same with Electronic Intifada. Our country is paying a tremendous price for its support for unjust policies with regard to Israel and Palestine. This is the biggest issue for people all over the Arab world and Muslim world in terms of the image and role of the U.S. And I think people need to know that we're paying a price for it and that it is within our power to have just policies which serve the cause of peace and security for Israelis and Palestinians together, that we have that choice.
What is the price that Americans are paying for U.S. policy toward Israel and Palestine?
We're paying a very high price. The basic bottom line is that we're subsidizing Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, and the direct military rule of millions of people who are denied the most basic freedom possible. A few weeks ago, Israel went into Rafah refugee camp in Gaza and destroyed the homes of 2,000 people in the space of just a couple of nights. Amnesty International called this a war crime. And the UN documented the destruction that was done to people's homes. What did the U.S. government call this? They called it self-defense. Amnesty International called it a war crime. Now, the price of that perception gap is that people all over the Arab world who admire the United States for many things, and that's shown consistently in study after study, that contrary to what George Bush believes, people in the Arab world and the Muslim world do love freedom, do love opportunity. They send their children here to study in enormous numbers and have done so historically. Arabs have been part of this country for more than 100 years. Arab Americans have reached some of the highest goals, posts this country has to offer. The larger price is that we're turning away from each other. The number of Arabs coming to this country to study, for medical care, to visit, for business, has plummeted because of post-9/11 restrictions on the one hand, and because of growing disgust with U.S. policies in the Arab world. That means that the opportunities for dialogue and contact are diminished. At the same time, Americans who already know very little, have very little direct experience about the Arab world, are going to those countries in even smaller numbers, and we are all reliant more and more on mass media, which caricatures, simplifies, vilifies, and mystifies and dehumanizes the other. Mm-hmm. And this is a catastrophe in the long term.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq. The admiration for the United States all over the world is fading, including in the Arab and Muslim world. And as a consequence, the cooperation that the United States needed to fight al-Qaeda, for instance, seems to be fading as well. Is that also one of the prices?
Well, it of course it's one of the prices. And the other price is that billions of people all over the world, I don't think that's an exaggeration, are angry, more angry with the United States than ever before. Now, billions of angry people are not going to hurt you, but among those billions are going to be a minority whose anger will turn to hatred, and then whose hatred will turn to a desire to hurt us. And so it seems to me self-evident that policies which this government has followed since 9/11 have made the world less safe, have made the world more hostile to the United States, that the war in Afghanistan left a smoldering wreck behind, that the war in Iraq has left a smoldering wreck and a quagmire behind, that these places are not the promised theaters of democracy and hope and reconstruction, but pits of despair and extremism and poverty. And we should know, because, you know, what is our history of doing this kind of thing? When was the last time we went in and put a country together? Haiti, which was invaded by the United States under the Clinton administration, which is a tiny country compared to Iraq, much less complex, is very close to our shores. We went into there promising democracy, promising prosperity, promising that the people of Haiti would not be abandoned. And we could not even keep our promises to that tiny little island. Haiti today is in more poverty and despair and violence, political violence, than ever before. And yet we're charging off to countries like Iraq, to Afghanistan, where we know absolutely nothing about the history, nothing about the people, and nothing about the culture. It's absolute insanity.
You mentioned before, Ali Abu Nima, the role of the media in vilification, distortion, stereotype. How has that played out vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine?
Well, it's a topic that we go into a lot on the Electronic Intifada. We have a lot of resources and analysis there. But I think, again, it's one of oversimplification, of reducing the issue to one of personalities, particularly vilifying Yasser Arafat and creating the impression that this is an issue that is unresolved because of the stubbornness of one elderly man.
What's wrong with that depiction?
Well, it's nonsensical, of course. If Yasser Arafat were to disappear today, what would change? You still have tens of thousands of heavily armed Israeli troops and hundreds of thousands of settlers occupying the West Bank and Gaza Strip. You still have millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who are ruled by a foreign military power. And you have millions of Palestinians languishing as refugees, as exiles, whose rights have been unfulfilled for decades. None of that changes. What you have here is a situation of two groups of people, one with a monopoly on military and economic and political power, and one that is almost completely powerless. And in that situation, you will have conflict. and you have violence. You have enormous violence. You have tremendous violence from the occupation. Israel's occupation and settlement policy could not be maintained and advanced without tremendous violence, daily violence against Palestinians. And the reaction to that is violence from Palestinians, which often takes the dreadful form of these hideous and reprehensible suicide bombings against Israeli civilians. But I think what our media has done, to a large extent, is to focus on Palestinian violence and to render invisible, to a large part, the Israeli violence, so that when you're watching this on, say, American television, you would believe that Israelis are the principal victims of violence, when in fact, three or four times as many Palestinians have been killed by Israel just in the past 3 years. So we need to recognize that violence, hatred, the expressions of hatred you hear from both sides are symptoms of great imbalance in power and great injustice. And those are the issues our media don't really want to discuss.
You said it's possible to implement or come up with just policies to solve this problem. What would those just policies be?
Well, an international consensus has developed over many years that a reasonable, workable solution to the conflict would involve the creation of two states, Israel and Palestine, which would live side by side in peace and allow these peoples to move towards a deeper reconciliation where in future they might have some kind of confederation like the European Union or something. But for that to happen, it requires Israel to end the occupation. And what we've seen since the peace process began in the early 90s is that rather than ending the occupation, Israel has doubled the number of settlers in the occupied territories. Israel has tightened its grip on the territory. And we've seen a succession of unworkable plans from Camp David to Taba to the Geneva Accords, which don't offer the Palestinians an end to the occupation and genuine independence, but some sort of semi-autonomy within the context of a greater Israel.
I'm speaking with Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. What do you make of the very prevalent argument in the United States espoused by such people as Tom Friedman that, look at Clinton and Barack offered Arafat the best deal he was ever going to have, the best deal the Palestinians were ever going to get, 95% of the land that they want, and he spurned the offer. And it was his fault. He was stupid to do so. And then he let loose the dogs of terrorism. And this is why we're in the mess we're in.
Well, this kind of demagoguery may work for an audience that doesn't know the facts, that isn't familiar with the realities of life. But really, in the end, you're only fooling yourself if you believe that, because what Palestinians need is an end to the occupation. And they need freedom. And that has never been contemplated by Israel. The so-called generous offers that Barack made and Clinton endorsed involved permanent Israeli control over Palestinian territory. It involved leaving most of the Israeli settlers and settlements in place on confiscated Palestinian land. It involved basically abrogating the basic rights of Palestinian refugees. And it was not something that was workable. And it is something that would simply have been the prelude to another war. So it was, if you read, a fantastic book by Tanya Reinhardt called Israel, Palestine, How to End the War of 1948, it's the best account I've read of this whole process. And what you see there is that it was essentially a setup so that Israel and its hardline supporters could say, we made this offer and they rejected it. But the same has always been true in history, in this country too. When you read the official history, it says that Native Americans were offered very generous deals to move to wonderful lands west of the Mississippi. And when they refused to do so, we had to help them along on the way. Had they only accepted these great offers, then, you know, these tragedies wouldn't have happened. This is what the powerful always say in order to justify the dispossession of weaker people.
Ali Abu Nima, it seems to me that the mainstream media in the United States, whether it's calculated or not, their product is to render almost inexplicable, almost totally irrational, the reaction by many Palestinians to either the Barak offer or protesting or even the reprehensible suicide bombings that you talked about before, which I totally deplore as a person who believes in nonviolence. But the pretense that this father with the two kids in the newspaper or this woman who just became a lawyer would strap on explosives and blow himself or herself up, the pretense of that person is insane, or that these people are just totally different than we are, is something that so renders Palestinians or the Palestinian cause inferior. Don't you see that playing a part here?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, I was talking about this with a colleague the other day, that, you know, when it comes to Arabs and Muslims and other groups of people of color, people are not entitled to their individuality. I mean, this is really an issue of, I think, you know, what some people call white privilege, that that Israelis, Europeans, North Americans are always entitled to their individuality, even when they commit heinous crimes. Tim McVeigh could blow up a federal building and kill almost 200 innocent people, and it has absolutely no impact on the perception of white male Irish Americans. White suburban kids can shoot up their schools and kill a dozen of their schoolmates, and it has no impact on our perception of white teenagers as a group. Yet whatever an Arab or a Muslim or a Korean or a South Asian does is attributed to the collectivity, to some kind of collective or cultural defect or mania. And that kind of, frankly, racism very much plays a part in our perceptions. At the same time, the fact that every human rights group that has looked into it has found that the Israeli army systematically opens fire on civilians, with the result that in the past 3 years, more than 400 Palestinian children have been killed. And never have I seen it, read it in any American newspaper, that the Israeli army is a group of people that like to murder children. Despite the fact that the Israeli army has killed 400 children, over 400 children, that Israeli human rights groups have documented this. Again, every incident is attributed to an individual, to a specific circumstance. And I think that, again, this kind of thing does make it harder for people to understand the dynamic.
And there's also the disproportionality of coverage. The suicide bombings get covered. The 400 Palestinian kids don't get as much coverage.
Exactly. And we've done a number of detailed reports on this at Electronic Intifada, of documenting periods which the media in this country generally refer to as, quote, periods of calm. Generally, a bomb will go off and they'll say it brought to an end a period of calm that lasted 3 weeks. And we've gone back through those so-called periods of calms and documented dozens of innocent Palestinians, children, elderly, men, women being killed. It's not reported in this country, and so those lives become invisible and dehumanized. And the fact that millions of people cannot conduct an ordinary life is simply invisible to us in this country. And once we start to understand that, we start to see that really you have two groups of people here. Neither of them is going to disappear. And unless you bring equality to them, the potential for conflict will never diminish.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq. On your webpage, you talk about a couple of visits you made to Shatila. Can you talk about that?
Yes, those were visits I made in the past couple of years to Shatila refugee camp in Beirut, the Palestinian refugee camp, which is perhaps most widely known in the world because it was one of the sites of a horrible massacre carried out by Israel's allies in 1982 when Israel was occupying Beirut under the command of then Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, and it was the site of atrocities. Since then, I've been to the camp a couple of times and spent time with a group of children there who've grown up in circumstances that are quite impossible for those of us who are fortunate enough not to be in them to comprehend, in terms of not just material deprivation, but a sense of complete abandonment by the Palestinian leadership, by the world, by the human rights community, and a sense of no future whatsoever. But I've really been incredibly affected by the strength and dignity that people have. Much of the work that I try to do here from a situation of real privilege, what keeps me going is a feeling of responsibility and kinship and connection to people I met in Shatila on those visits, and not just to Shatila, but other Palestinian refugee camps that I've had an opportunity to be in. It's something I reflect on often, that my parents were both born in Palestine. My mother and her family were forced from their village in 1948. My father's village is in the West Bank, right on the Green Line. It's simply an accident that I'm sitting here in this studio, that I live a life of privilege and comfort in the United States, because someone in my mother's family decided to go left instead of right. Mm-hmm. Had they walked in another direction, I may well be in any one of those refugee camps. There's no difference, and this is the important point. There's no difference between me as a Palestinian and refugees. We tend to think of refugees as sort of a separate category of people. But what needs to be understood is that people who become refugees are people like you and me who lead normal lives. And one day, their entire world is taken away from them. And peace cannot be made without justice for refugees. Peace has to be made with them, not against them or trying to get around them.
On the refugee issue, a lot of Israelis believe that if Palestinians were granted the right of return that Jews have to go to Israel, that the very nature of the Israeli state would be forever altered and that this is therefore a non-starter of an issue. How do you respond to that?
Well, the argument is that, you know, Israel is a Jewish state and therefore has to have a Jewish majority. Otherwise, if there's a Jewish minority, it either has to become a state with equal rights for all its citizens or an apartheid state where a Jewish majority rules a Jewish minority rules a non-Jewish majority. So because Israelis want to avoid being in that situation, they say Palestinians can't come back. Now, there are two ways to look at this. One is as a practical matter. No one has suggested that all or most of the 4 million Palestinian refugees will return. There is vast space between the extreme positions on both sides. Israelis say not a single refugee can return, and there is a handful of Palestinians who say everyone must return. Everyone else is saying that refugees have to have choices which respect their fundamental rights. And when you're in a situation of, say, a two-state solution, then you can come up with all sorts of ways to respect those rights and to deal with some of the fears of Israelis. That's a practical response, but you can't get to it unless Israel agrees to discuss it, and so far they haven't agreed to do that. The other response I have is to say, well, you know, today you have in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the whole of historic Palestine, roughly equal numbers of Palestinians and Israelis. And within a few years, Palestinians are going to be a majority. Everyone acknowledges that. And so in the long run, this so-called demographic crisis that Israel has is coming down the pike anyway. So maybe it's time, as some Israeli intellectuals and Palestinian intellectuals have been discussing recently, to think about a different solution, that we can have a thriving Israeli Jewish culture in Israel-Palestine, whose rights and presence is guaranteed and recognized and affirmed by all, but without insisting on a situation of Jewish monopoly on political power, that we move towards a multi-ethnic state like in South Africa, like the United States.
I'm speaking with Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq. I know Edward W. Said moved to this one-state solution in the last couple of years of his life. The response by some Israelis and by some Jewish Americans is that, who are we kidding here? As soon as Palestinians get a majority in Israel and have the same voting rights as Israelis, they'll take over and they'll wipe the Jews in Israel out, or they'll push them out, or they'll do something horrible to them. And the suicide, some of the suicide bombings tend to reinforce those fears. How would you allay those?
Well, I can certainly understand how suicide bombings reinforce those fears, but also the violence that Israel is doing to Palestinians reinforces the fears of Palestinians. The talk we hear coming from not people on the fringe in Israel, but Israeli cabinet ministers talking about a solution based on the ethnic cleansing of all Palestinians from the country certainly aren't comforting to Palestinians. So we hear these fears on both sides. My response is twofold. On the one hand, my hard response is, look, that was the response that many white South Africans had to demands to end apartheid. It's not a good enough reason to maintain apartheid. That was the response that racists in this country had to preventing voting rights for African Americans, women, and others. That as soon as these people get power, they'll take their revenge on those who have held power till now. My response from the heart is that, of course, there's anger and hatred and pain for all of us. But I think we have to change the way we think about this, that I think that Palestinians and Israelis can live together, that they are already doing so to a surprising extent given the conflict between them. The latest suicide bombing was in Haifa, in a restaurant that was owned by Arabs and Israelis, Israeli Jews, and the victims were Arabs and Israeli Jews. And that created, actually brought people closer together in Haifa. And Haifa is a city where most of the Palestinian population were ethnically cleansed in 1948. Yet even with that history, people lived together in Haifa. And I believe that that's something that once we remove this unnatural situation of occupation and domination, that people can move together.
Well, on that hope, we're going to have to end the show. Ali Abu Nima, thanks so much for being my guest today.
It's been a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.